So we're in the book of Job. Andy did an introduction and started us and went through chapter one. We're going to continue, but I'm going to kind of do an overview slash review of the introduction, some of the things that we touched on, and then we're going to be in chapter two. We're going to really today only look at verses 1 to 10. And I don't know if you recall, but Andy had mentioned that our approach overall is we're not going to go through each passage, but we're going to look at sections, draw out some things there. And as you guys are studying this on your own, reading this on your own, if there are things that you found that you said, hey, I think this would really be helpful, please share that. That's always engagement, as I know we both look for that. And so feel free to share the things that you're learning in this process as well. So there are some things that we'll talk about as we're doing the overview of why this book, some of the complexities in it, but there is the commentators. There's one that I've found that I kind of like some of his stuff. That's really what you'll see, some quotes from him today. I think he does a good job framing what it is that we're looking at in the book of Job. So his name is Francis Anderson. He says, upon this simple plot, an unknown writer of superlative genius has erected a monumental work. The most persistent questions of the relationship of men to God have been given powerful theological treatment in verse whose majesty and emotion are unsurpassed in any literature, ancient or modern. And then he goes on to talk about the particular struggles and the things that happened in the book of Job. He says, it reaches widely over the complexities of existence, seeking a place for animals as well as men in God's world. It plumbs the depths of human despair, the anger of moral outrage, and the anguish of desertion by God. From one man's agony, it reaches out to the mystery of God beyond all words and explanations. It is only God himself who brings Job joy in the end. And when all is done, the mystery remains. God stands revealed in his hiddenness, an object of terror, adoration, and love. And Job stands before him like a man, trusting and satisfied. And I really appreciate the distinction that he makes there, because there's tensions that are happening in this book that are hard to reconcile, right? We just walked through in Ecclesiastes a very similar thing. There were things that were hard to reconcile and seemingly almost contradictory. And we'll, as we go through this overview here, we'll kind of touch on the similarities between those. But I do want to just read the passage that we'll be looking at today, and then we'll go on those verses. So Job chapter 2, we're going to start in verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and flesh, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery, which to scrape himself, while he sat in ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God and not receive evil? And all this Job did not sin with his lips. And we'll stop there. Next week we'll pick up that next verse and start to look at those three friends' arrival. But in this section today, we'll examine a couple passages here there. In the beginning, it's exactly the same as chapter one, as the sons of God are coming to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan comes with them. And then the same things are said until God says he holds fast his integrity. And again, we'll get into that in a few minutes. But there's a lot of this writing is very complex, and we'll look at maybe one of the reasons why that's the case. It's hard for them to understand sources for the book of Job. A lot of times they look to many places and say, where else do we see these phrases? That phrase in there, skin for skin, they don't know what it means. Like, it's really unusual. There's one other place that they find something like that. But we read it, we kind of have a sense of what that means, but when they don't, there were no other idioms out there that they were looking at saying, oh, that's where this comes from. So there's a lot of complexity in trying to get into that. And frankly, I don't have the depth to like chase that down and share that with you. If you want, there are a lot of things written on Job and a lot of that very work of the language and trying to understand where it came from. But I can tell you that there are a lot of different opinions on that still. Job also was, there are a lot that will compare it to other books in other places in the world, and they'll say, oh, this is similar to this that was written in Egypt, or this was written in Southeast Asia somewhere, or all these different places, and they're saying these are very similar stories. But when you go through them, actually none of them hold up, specifically because they don't come from the perspective of God is sovereign over these things that are happening and the wrestle that Job specifically has. We talked about that some in Ecclesiastes, about the preacher, and that his ultimate struggle was not the difficulties he saw in the world, but that God was sovereign over them. And Job has a little bit different here. We'll look at that in a minute. An overview of Job. Who was the author?
We're not sure.
Any guesses?
Perhaps Moses.
Okay, who else?
Solomon.
Maybe Solomon. They talk about that. And it, you know, a lot of that we're going to see is depends on what the how you date it. What's that?
Heard Ezra.
Ezra, yeah. Yep.
Holy Spirit.
There you go. That's, yeah, co-author for sure, right? Yeah. So, and some even say Job, but what's the problem with Job himself being the author?
He didn't know the events that were...
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The things that were happening there, the struggle that he goes through in the midst of that. So there are a lot of people that are suggested for who the author might be. But the one thing about the author is that he was not only, this is also from that Francis Anderson, he says, he was not only sensitive and intelligent, he was experienced and cultivated. When you go through the things that are said, particularly as God speaks, they're stunning, the things that he says. Like, there are things that you're saying, how did they figure this out? When he's talking about snow and ice, and you're like, was that really in this region? Like, how would they comprehend that? There are lots of things, a very wide span of all these animals. This person understood animals really, really well, right? And so whoever the author was, the Spirit was as well, of course, but had a lot of knowledge that they continue to examine to this day. All right, so the author was unknown. Good. You got an A so far. What about the date?
A long time ago.
Okay, I'll accept that. The date is unknown. Does anybody have, like, ideas of when it may have been written? Yes, sir.
I've heard 600 BC.
Okay.
Or older.
Right. Yep. Anyone else?
Around the time of the patriarchs.
Around the time of the patriarchs. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
What the land of Uz, where Job was from, wasn't they were, Uz was one of the sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, right?
Right.
So I'm thinking, was it Eve around that time, right? Is that...
It was, that's one of the, as I've looked at it, I think it's right after the Tower of Babel, that's the time that you see. And really that feeds into, that goes to the location is also unknown, even though we have the land of Uz that it specifically says it, but where that is, we'll look at a map here in a second. It's a wide swath that could possibly be, so it's mostly unknown. But it's interesting to consider that it would be post-flood, and because he references some things that in early in Genesis, but after the Tower of Babel, that when you look at that the languages that God had made confused so that they would spread out, and it's really interesting to me as I've been going through this, how confused they are trying to understand the book of Job. And think about that. If there was all one language at one point, and all of a sudden the languages all changed, well, at that moment, it's going to be hard to reconcile a lot of things that are happening in language. Because all of a sudden, they're all changing, and they're starting to spread out. And so, again, that's more complex than I could, and deep than I can go, but it's an interesting thing to consider, the difficulty in the language, and that it's at a moment in history when all of a sudden there became multiple languages, that God intentionally confused languages. And so that's part of the difficulty in them looking at this. So locations, we'll look at that in a second. There's a map that I'll show you. So author unknown, date unknown, location unknown. What genre is this? What set of books does this belong to? Wisdom books. Which really cracked me up as I was building this slide, because you go, oh, this is unknown, this is unknown, this is unknown. Oh, this is the wisdom book, right? It didn't seem to fit, but that is where it belongs. As far as the date, I think I kind of jumped by that. There are some that would put it back to 2242, to that, around that stage, up to, you know, if it's Solomon, 931, somewhere around there, but that's a 1,300-year difference or whatever. So it's, again, a wide swath. All right, what's the setting? What's the initial setting of the book of Job? There's two places of setting. Okay. And where else? That's right, we already mentioned it. The other one is the land of Uz, right? Because I love the way it starts. There was a man in the land of Uz. It's a pretty simple start. And really, it's a simple story in lots of ways. There's not a lot of complexity in the disasters that came upon him. Now, the dialogue that happens, there's a lot of difficulty there. And I'll just speak to that for a second. So as far as, I know Andy made an outline. I don't have an outline that I'm going to show you, but primarily it's prologue, dialogue, epilogue. That's the big picture, and you can keep leaning that down. There's many conversations that Andy did a good job breaking those out. Who's speaking when, the cycles that goes through. Chapter 28 is somewhat unique. In the midst of that, it'll be a while before we get there. But it's unique. It's almost this interlude in the middle of all of it. But it's just think of it, prologue, dialogue, epilogue is the main thing. And so what is the purpose of this book? What is the purpose of this book?
When I read your question, I thought to explore the purpose of personal suffering was my initial answer, but I could say the origin of personal suffering.
Excellent. That's why I like you, because we think alike. It's not origin, but I like that. That would have been better. Source is what I said, but origin fits too. And is that not one of the biggest struggles that we have in life? Almost every time you see some great suffering happening, whether it's you personally or you see it somewhere else outside of you, the question that comes up in our mind is why? Why did that happen? And a common question that you'll hear the world generally ask is, why do good people suffer, right? And as a well-trained church, we have answers to those things that we would respond in certain ways. But the irony is, this is a good man that suffers. God testifies to that over and over in this book about Job's blame. He has no blame and did not sin. So here is someone who's not Christ, who is a good man who does suffer. We'll talk about that a little bit.
That's a good point. You know, maybe we're too quick to say, well, you know, show me a good man, you know.
Not a good.
Snarky.
Right.
Maybe, that just made me think about that, how we answer people, because they're, relatively speaking, you do see people that are living right lives. You don't know their heart, you know, but ours is for no good. They weren't good, you know, and you're going, you know what they were really asking is, this person wasn't doing evil.
Right.
Right?
Right,
and why did this happen to them? And we need to be maybe a little more sensitive to that. God was.
Yeah,
God,
yeah, absolutely.
Like, where's the good person?
Right, no, he did. That's right. Because he said, this man's good.
Yeah, that's it.
It is an interesting thing. And that is, without getting too far down that rabbit trail, I think that's important because the question generally being asked there is related to suffering, and there's a right theological sense in which you have to understand your position before God, like all men, their position before God, is you start as his enemy. Yeah? Yet those that are in Christ are not his enemy, but are adopted sons, and they suffer too. And we looked at that in Ecclesiastes.
And they would be considered good.
Like that's right.
Job was. Job
right.
wasn't sinless good.
No, that's right. Stop jumping ahead, Mark. No, it is. And so where does suffering come from? So what is your answer? What is the world's answer generally when you talk about where does suffering, why do good people suffer? Sin, okay.
World would say bad luck.
Okay. What else?
Karma. You're getting what you deserve.
Okay, yeah. Yep.
But from this, we see it comes from God.
It comes from God. That's where suffering comes from. Again, I said this in Ecclesiastes, the same thing here. That's a tough pill to swallow. The believer actually has the harder thing to deal with, is because this is by the hand of a good God. How do you reconcile that? That is tough, and we'll be. That's why this is the tour of woe, because it's difficult things to work through. Sincerely, it is when we see the things that happen in the world, and even personal suffering. And we'll look at the comparison between these two in a minute. But the case of Job. This is another quote. The case of Job precipitates the test of faith in its severest form. And the supremely righteous man who sustains the most extreme calamities. How can he or anyone continue to believe that God is right and fair in what he sometimes does to people? There could be no doubt that it is God, only God, who is responsible for all that happens to Job. It cannot be blamed on nature or the devil, for these things are but his creatures. And so that's an important thing for us to remember, because you also hear those that I would generally call them spiritual, or might even claim to be Christian, to say it's the devil that did it, right? They're blaming Satan. But we have a very clear picture here of how that works, right? And even a claim that God makes, and some of this stuff we'll look in a few minutes. So the purpose is, what is the source of suffering? And the question that's being asked is, why do good people suffer? We just talked about that. But more particularly in the book of Job, why me? That's what Job's asking. Why me? Right? The distinction between Ecclesiastes and Job is the preacher, the teacher, was thinking philosophically. He's thinking existentially for all humanity, why are things this way? This is my suffering, right? The suffering that he goes through is great suffering, great personal suffering. So the why me? And that's a big difference between these two books. And I think it's just great in God's word that we have those pictures, because you can be more philosophical and stand off and look at how things operate in the world. And yet when you suffer, when you have pain of some kind, if you have something that's difficult, you're saying, why me? Why is this happening? Especially when it doesn't relent. So here's a map. So this over here is the Persian Gulf, and the Tower of Babel was over here. And he's actually all the way over here. I don't know how well you can see that, but this is the land of Uz. I'm not going to be able to look there and do it here. That's interesting. But, I mean, they really don't know, because there are attacks that come from here. There are attacks that come from over here. There are attacks that come from here against Job. And it's a wide swath. So they don't really know. They're just, you know, kind of say it's in this area, in this triangle somewhere. So that's just to kind of give you a sense of where that is. So we'll look at Ecclesiastes and Job. We're going to compare the two of them. Just a few things there that we'll walk through. They're both wisdom books, and both the authors are never declared. And for both of them, they suggest potentially multiple authors. Actually, one of the reasons is for the same thing, because of the prologue and epilogue in each of them. Because they say, oh, this is somebody commenting on, somebody wrote this book, and somebody came behind and they commented on, so they could help people understand what that book meant. It's just one of the ways that they might look at that. The preacher had great wealth. I'm sorry. Yeah, he had great wealth. And he was concerned, because he was going to have to give it all away, right? Who knows what the man comes after me won't be a fool. And that was one of his concerns, is that he had all the, not just his wealth, but the works that he did. That was actually probably a bigger concern for him, was the work that he did. But all that he had accomplished is just going to be handed off to somebody. That bothered him, because he didn't know what he could do to make that be that person deal with those things rightly. Job also had great wealth. And just think of the contrast. Solomon uses his great wealth to pursue this question that he has. Job loses all of his wealth, in which he pursues the question that he has. So the contrast there between the two, both of them had great wealth. One of them had everything taken away. One of them had everything that remained with him. Both trying to figure out an answer to this question. And it's interesting, you know, sometimes we can be tempted to think, if I only had X, Y, Z, whatever it might be, because the next one is related to wisdom, right? And the preacher had the greatest of wisdom, and yet he was confounded with this question. He was vexed. And so he pursued that in his worldly wisdom. And even though he had divine wisdom, he couldn't find the answer in worldly wisdom. And in Job, he has great integrity. And so he's making a demand. Mark and I were actually talking about this in prayer this morning, just the fact that how Job, some of the demands he makes against God are stunning. It's like, how can you say things like that? I'm sorry, it wasn't you, it was Jack.
Who was the other Mark?
No, it was Jack. And it's just stunning to say that I have no faults. I want to go to court against God. That's a pretty stunning thing to say. And yet, Job maintained his integrity the whole time. And so he's pursuing, he's saying, why is this thing happening? And all his friends are measuring the things that are happening in his life by Job's integrity. And they're saying, something's not right here. There's some sin that you've committed that you need to confess, because these things are happening. But that's a certain mindset of how the world works, and we'll touch on that as we go through.
It seems like they even invent that in their mind, like they actually come up with examples. It's not like they just, at one point they start accusing him. It seems like they actually invent some examples of how he was evil.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And what I would say, I examine myself in the midst of this, wouldn't I do the same? When I see something going on miserable in somebody's life, the first thing that's in my mind is the way they're choosing to live. That's causing all of the stuff. That's just naturally how we think. When we see somebody who's got horrible circumstances, and you say, have you brought these things on yourself? What things are you doing? It's easy for us. Right? We look at the Bible and we read about Job's three friends and we go, oh, they were terrible. And Andy talked about this some. And yet we get to that same place. When you see somebody that's cursed. When we went over to Nigeria a few years ago, my oldest son went with us and there's just, in the middle of town, it's just, the traffic is insane. Like most third world countries, it's always crazy. But there are just vehicles everywhere, trucks and motorcycles flying around all over. I don't know. I don't think they have any kind of patterns or anything. They just make it through somehow. That's the way it felt everywhere we went. And so we come to this place where we're stopped, but it's a rotary. And so you know there's no, it's not like a stoplight or anything, or there's no stop signs. And so there was this young man, probably late teens, early 20s, who was on... if you think of one of those things that you would slide underneath a car, like a mechanic, you know, that little thing that has wheels on it, and you'd slide underneath, so this little cart thing, and he's kneeling on it. You can't really tell what's going on with his legs, but there's something not right. And he has gloves on so he can move himself across. So there are all these people that are piled up, and I'm looking. I couldn't make it across there, like at midnight probably, right? I'm thinking, how do you ever do that? And so he's only this tall because he's on his knees, And he's trying to get across this thing. And I'm like terrified for him watching this whole thing. And it's pathetic to see him going across. Well, my son's watching the same thing. Everybody's just like, what's going to happen? This guy's not going to survive this. And yet he was skilled at doing that. And eventually he made his way all the way across. He gets to the other side, and there's an old man there, and the old man spits on him. It still affects me, sorry. That's somebody who's, he sees him as cursed. That's why he's spitting on him. He's saying, you deserve this. And so we can judge people in that same way. We see their lives, we see the things that they struggle in, and sometimes we say they deserved it. Something brought that about. Because that's what his friends are saying. There's got to be something. God's not evil. He's not just going to have these things happen for no reason. That's part of the struggle that we go through here. So like we said, the suffering that the preacher went through in Ecclesiastes was existential. He's looking at all mankind. Why is this happening? But for Job, it's directly personal. He's going through a great deal personally. Like, and it's as the book is written, it's intended that way. Andy talked about that last week, that it's overwhelming the way these things, that each person shows up before they're even done talking, the next person's coming in, telling them the next disaster that has come. So, the preacher struggled with God's sovereignty in that the affliction and the suffering that happens. Job is actually struggling with God's justice, because Job is saying, I've done nothing wrong. Again, bold and scary when I think of that, right? Because I think we all just naturally know we do things wrong. And yet Job makes that claim. God confirms that claim about Job. And so his struggle is actually with God's justice. How is this thing happening if I'm doing all of the right things, if I'm a blameless man? The question answered in Ecclesiastes, it's at the end of the matter, all has been heard, fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. And so the answer for the struggle of Ecclesiastes is God's sovereignty, and the answer is God's justice. That's that saying, everything is going to be judged. We talked about in the beginning of Ecclesiastes that one of the concerns is there a judge on the bench, or is all of this just meaningless? Is there nobody that is keeping account of the things that happen? And in Ecclesiastes, he's struggling with God's sovereignty, but the answer he gets has to do with God's justice. In Job 40, verse 1, but actually it's all the last chapters there. Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. And so for Job, he's struggling with God's justice, and the answer is God's sovereignty. It's a funny thing when we get there, right? When Job is saying, why me? Why the suffering? Why are these things going on? What are those last chapters? What is God saying? What's he talking about?
His absolute control and his right to do these things.
He talks about creation. That's it. He's just saying his dominance, all of creation, the things that he brought about. So when someone says, you know, when someone comes to him in Job and says, why am I suffering? And he says, I created everything. That's his response is, I'm sovereign over those things. Yet there's an earlier answer that's actually in this that we're going to look at today. So Job's answer is God's sovereignty, chapters 38 to 42. So then a quick review here. There was a man in Uz. He was blameless and upright, feared God and turned away from evil, which ironically is the end of Ecclesiastes, right? Fear God and obey his commandments, because everyone will be judged. Well, Job 28:28 says a very similar thing. And this is the claim by God, that he feared God and shunned evil, and that he was blameless and upright. And like Mark said, which is really important, blameless does not mean sinless. That's not, and Job admits that he sins, right? One of the things in chapter 1 that's kind of an indicator, what it's trying to do is show you Job's character. They want you to know this is a righteous man. This is the good man that suffers. And they go through a lot of lengths to make sure that he's doing sacrifices for his children, right? He wants their to be a mediator, and he's doing those sacrifices in case they've cursed God, which we'll talk about curse in a second. Yes, sir.
I might have missed, maybe it wasn't even there. Did you go over the difference between blameless and sinless?
Sinless is have committed no sin. Blameless is that you have right standing before God, that you are righteous. Yeah. Just like a believer, yes, sir.
Well, God is so adamant about his righteousness that in Ezekiel, he tells Ezekiel to tell Jerusalem they're not going to stand, but he said Noah, Daniel, and Job and their righteousness could stand.
Yeah, that's so one of the things that, thank you for saying that, and I appreciate your point. One of the things that Andy also touched on is, was this a real person, right? And it's in other parts of Scripture, this definitely was a real person. And James, it's there as well. I think there's four total places, something like that. But you're exactly right. And the thing that's interesting is, was Job a Jew? Because it's funny to think of a prophet naming these people and putting somebody in there. And I don't know if he was a Jew or not. I have no idea. We don't know exactly. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's the point that is being made is that he is a righteous, blameless man that is going to experience this suffering. So he had abundance. And, you know, when they talk about wealth, it's the livestock and the number of sheep and ox and all these other things. You're talking about that. And then his children, really that number of children that he had was, would any mom and dad would be thrilled to have that many. So they had great, great abundance. Part of this is the same as, you know, as you examine Solomon's life and the beginning of Ecclesiastes, is to get you the picture, this is the top. Like this is the guy that's at the top, has all the stuff that you need, that you think that if you had something, he's got it all. And what happens with him? And it's done the same in both. The curse part, And it's to present a greater contrast so that we can see that. The curse part, the curse, that word curse here in Hebrews used four times, but in these sections, in the first two chapters, it's really, that word is really blessed. It's really interesting. We're going to look at something in that in a minute. But part of it is the hesitancy to talk about God's curse. The author was hesitant to be saying that. And so the Hebrew word is actually means bless. And we'll... Again, like I said, we'll look at another piece of that. And then that he's sacrificing for his family just to show his uprightness. And so it's a heavenly scene. When we were going through Ecclesiastes, where was that setting? It should fly off your lips.
I picture him riding in his castle.
Where was the setting overall? What was it talking about? Under the sun. Right? It was under the sun. It's the earth. And here we have the starts in a heavenly scene. And so as Satan comes to God, it's still like, it's just the way I think of it. It's probably not, I'm sure it's not accurate, but I just think Satan comes, God says, from where have you come? And I think it's just, I just see Satan, I forget the cartoon or whatever, but he's keeping from going to and fro on the earth, like he's, because he's being told that from where have you come? From where I've cast you to be, right? He wants him to understand who's in charge. That's what it's presenting. He's going to and fro on all the earth. And they, you know, they do it twice. And then we've talked about this piece too, you might try to give God a break by saying, well, Satan came and presented this, so God responded. No. God initiated the whole thing. He initiated the whole thing. Another area of contrast to say that God brought this very thing about.
Wait, are we saying this is heaven?
Job is, yes. When the sons of God come and visit, come to see God and Satan comes with them, it's talking about heaven, yeah.
What about sin being present in heaven?
That's a great question that I'm not going to answer. No, it sincerely is a good question because he can't be in the presence of sin. I know what this says.
I thought I heard y'all talking about that. That's why I've been we're trying to figure out, did I hear that correctly?
Yeah. It's a hard thing to reconcile.
Does it say specifically it is heaven?
Yeah, yeah, it comes before God. We're going to keep moving on. You could stay there and marinate for a little while, but I don't have an answer how that happens, how Satan comes before God, because it says that God cannot be in the presence of sin. So how does that work? I'm not sure. But luckily, there's lots of things I don't know, so you'll catch many of them, I'm sure. So a bad day, right? When we look at this with Job, it was a bad day, and it makes me think when I've had bad days and how I respond in the midst of those things. I'll tell you a quick story. A few years ago, I started changing routines in my life, and maybe it's just because I was getting older and I couldn't do as much, I have no idea, but all of a sudden I'm much more routine. I like routine, never really appreciated routine in life. I'm liking routine, and I'm changing various things, and I'm really liking these things. And so one day, I don't know exactly what happened, watch didn't wake me up or whatever, so I get up a little bit later, and I have all these things that I do in the morning, and I couldn't do my routine. And so this was unpleasant for me. It was the first time I really had experienced it, because I kept adding things, and all of a sudden, I'm knocked out of my routine. And so things aren't going well, I'm trying to do this, and while I'm reading the Bible, it's just like I'm thinking, all right, I got to get on to the next thing. And so I'm getting anxious over the whole thing, and it's all bothering me. And as you guys have all experienced in life, various things keep happening as I'm going along that are just frustrating. A shirt I'm looking for isn't where it is, you know, just everything that's going wrong. And the thing that finally broke me was I had my pajama bottoms on, and I had the tie strings on it. And I'm at the bathroom sink, and I close the bathroom drawer, and my tie strings get stuck in there, and I go to go away, and they yank. And really, the thought goes through my mind is, why, God? Why am I suffering? Like, how could you get those strings stuck in that drawer? That doesn't make sense. Even if I tried a million times, that wouldn't happen. And it's just and it just knocked me out, right? And I think of how I broke down, in one sense, not I didn't break down in that, but I was getting frustrated in that kind of bad day. Now, consider the contrast we're talking about, Job. What's happening with him? That these things, one after another, right, that are happening. It's we're going to talk through it a little bit more, but that bad day, we've all had it. I've had conversations with other people even this morning about having a bad day. And in light of what? You know, when we consider that.
Don't compare yourself to Job when you're...
Yes, yes. Or cut those strings or something. I don't know.
Like Job.
That's right. Yeah. He and I. It's just like me. Yep, exactly. And yet, as we finish that, what was Job's response?
Worship.
And he did not charge God with wrong. That is one of the most stunning responses in all of Scripture. It sincerely is. Again, because I'm about to give up on the day and go back to bed because my jammies get stuck. So again, another quote from him: "The Old Testament book about Job is one of supreme offerings of the human mind to the living God, and one of the best gifts of God to men. The task of understanding it is as rewarding as it is strenuous." So we're going to look at Job 2, verse 3. Would someone read that for us?
"The Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause.'"
Thank you. So there are some really interesting things that are happening in the midst of this. And, you know, one of the first things is that God is proclaiming the victory of Job, that of what just happened, right? That he maintained his integrity in the midst of all these things that came at him. And yet, what did that victory cost? That's why I have those in quote. We'll talk about that with Satan in a minute too. But what did that victory cost Job?
Everything. His
possessed?
Everything earthly. Yeah. You know, often when, if I'm trying to talk to somebody, not necessarily about Christ, but if it's about Christ as well, one of the questions that goes through my mind is, at what cost? Actually, Patty's very, very helpful. This is something she helped me to stay focused on, is at what cost are you keep pushing this conversation? Keep digging in to that relationship. Is there damage that's happening in the midst of it that isn't worth what you're trying to get to? And you have to consider, what is the cost of that? And when you look at Job and you see what the cost was for him, that's a significant cost, right? Lose all his wealth, his prestige, like his ability to, like, he had all these servants, all these various things, and then at the end of that, all his kids. That cost him a lot to maintain his integrity. And how quickly can we bend in our integrity for things, right? Whether it's pay a little less taxes, right? To get a promotion, to get in line a little further, right? We give up our integrity quite quickly. And yet this costs Job every earthly thing. And so did Satan lose in this, in the midst of this? Did Satan lose this wager with God? Good, the first round, yes. He did. It's demonstrated right there, where he says, he still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me to destroy him without reason. And so he says that, and Satan's response to that is, yeah, but, right? It's actually interesting, because the one thing God said in that first encounter that he couldn't do was touch him physically. And Satan's response is, well, if you just let me do that thing, then I'll win. You kind of tilted the scale. You didn't let things operate in a way that was fair.
That was fair.
Yeah. Right? So Satan did clearly lose there. But if you look at, let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 8, because it's an interesting thing to consider. Just because of time, I'm not going to jump through all of these, but so I'll start in verse 2. Is you remember the way that the Lord your God has led you for 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. He goes on to talk about your clothing didn't wear out and all the ways in which God has supplied the people. And if you go down to verse 11, he says, take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest you, when you have eaten and are full and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart will be lifted up and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. This wager that happens actually continues to this day for the heart of every man. Is who is supreme? Chris was preaching on this very thing this morning. Who is supreme? Because, and in Romans 1, it speaks of the very same concept. That we know that God created, and we know him, but we'd rather have the creature than the creator, the gift instead of the giver. And that today, even to today, we struggle. That wager goes on. God's examining our hearts. He's seeing where we stand before him. Where does our integrity stand? So this, it was ironic as I looked through this. That wager continues through all humanity, because we always struggle, and I know I do too. When things are difficult, it often is a lot easier for me to hold on to God, but it's actually when abundance and blessing comes that's a little bit easier to start letting go and somehow getting our eyes off of him and thinking we do those things in our own strength. And so this continues. Satan's loss is a battle that happens in the heart of all mankind, even to this day. So much of Job's defense in the next 34 chapters is related to the fact that he is suffering innocently, not that he is sinless. We talked about that a little bit earlier. And then at the very end of this, it's actually, this is the answer right here, that there are a lot of chapters where his friends are accusing him of all sorts of things, but the answer is right here. God says he still holds his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. That there wasn't a purpose in this. See, when Job's asking, why me? Why am I suffering? This is the answer. There wasn't that kind of purpose in it, Job. There wasn't something that was efficacious, something that you did that caused this to come about. And it was by God's hand, by God's decree. And 9 and 10, it says, Job 2, 9 and 10. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin. So here we, like many people know about Job's wife, right? Some people, I think we've even talked about it a little bit, that Satan took away all these earthly things and left his wife, and that was intentional, right? To cause him some additional pain and suffering. And he left these three friends too, and it's actually very true. The suffering that Job had gone through, that the things that he goes through with those friends, with his wife, is worse than those things. But what Satan is allowed to do here, all those other things were external. In this second test, it's actually internal, right? Because it's in his skin for skin. And so it's a disease. And so just think about that part of suffering and affliction. Things are hard and just mental anguish over if you consider that you lost 10 children, like in one day, right? I just can't comprehend what that would be. I don't know that you could say things are much harder. But there is a different kind of suffering when we suffer in the body, when we have some sort of health thing that's affecting us.
Yeah, because you got to know the boils were painful. You're taking pot sherds. I never did really do that, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's mostly related to itching. Some people say different things, but actually, yeah, I got to speed up here. Because basically, he probably went out to a dump. He's sitting on ashes, so there's just a bunch of broken stuff there. He considers himself as human refuse, that he's just trash, that he just wants this to be over. Ironically, when God said you can do those things, right, that you can give him those boils and give him that disease, he said only do not take his life. And you can read that as a kindness, and I would tell you God is always kind, so it is a kindness. But it isn't necessarily the way we think. Because what would Job be seeking? Death. That's the way of escape. And God stopped that. He said, you can't kill him. Because his integrity has to last through this or the test is false. Right? If death was an option for him. But, so in this test, it would be internally, Job's own skin. Suffering in the body is different, as I said. Sitting on a trash heap. And it's just stunning to consider where he's at, all those things that have happened. One other thing I wanted to say, those disasters that happen, these friends that are coming, when the friends come, they didn't hop on the Excel train. They didn't see it on Facebook and hop on the Excel train and they were there in a few hours, right? That's not what happened. This is something that went on a long time. We'll touch on that more next week. So that word curse, I told you that it said, it's actually the word, a Hebrew word for bless. So here, when his wife says, curse God and die, consider it this way. Maybe his wife was suffering for her husband. All the things that she's seeing going on. Maybe she's seeing him and wanting this to end. Not wanting to punish him in some way. Right? In one sense, she may be asking for a blessing from God. God bless him by killing him. Let him escape this suffering, this difficulty. You know, it's really easy to think of her in a certain way that she's coming at him very negatively. And I don't know for sure one way or the other, but consider their life. We're getting to that. Slow down, my friend. Yeah, no, we're going to get to that because that's important. But consider the context of their life. They had great blessing in their life. They had children that they were that was joyful. They had wealth. They had abundance. And she knows his integrity. Here's one of the big differences between her and the friends. She knows his integrity. She doesn't question his integrity. She just says, curse God and die. Not that you've done something wrong that's brought all this on, but she wants her husband to be released from the suffering that's happening. She's seeking to have him removed from it.
Question you said earlier is why me? And her question would be why him? These were her children also. She bore the children.
Mm-hmm.
She lost her children. She's seeing her husband suffer. And to see your spouse suffer is hard. To see, you wonder, here's a person that loves God, who's doing these things, everything, and to see them go through what they go through, you wonder, why them?
And God, just please take them. Like, and I'm sure many of you have been at that same place where somebody was on that path, they were going to die, and your desire was have it happen sooner. That's where they're headed. And it's a loving response. It's not a mean response. It's not a hateful response. It's actually one of compassion for that person, that suffering would end.
And the good news is, at the end of Job, they have children again.
Don't tell everyone.
She's stuck with it.
Yeah, yeah. But that's part of, so let's talk about his response to her briefly, but that's part of the things that's hard for him, is now his wife, that she seems to be giving up, and his response to her is, you speak like one of the foolish women, right? But just as I thought through that, that is a way for us to you know, regard what was said before, but was his response unloving to her? Think of another circumstance where there was someone that was rebuked in the New Testament. What's that?
Get thee behind me, Satan. Yeah.
Peter, exactly. That's Jesus wasn't unloving because he was never unloving. And it was the most loving thing he could do is tell him that.
Correct. That's interesting.
That's it. Yeah. And so here...
I've never heard that.
Temptation, his affliction already, mm-hmm. tempting him to go ahead. Yeah. She says, you still hold fast your integrity.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's...
a little more sense, than mm-hmm. the traditional. I've never mm-hmm. heard this as even an option.
Well, that scares me. I don't ever want to be in that place, but it's as I'm going through it, and actually one of the commentators was talking about a similar thing, and it seems because she knew she doesn't question his integrity, she knows his integrity, and then the three friends come and they're saying, repent, if you repent you'll be released from this. His wife is saying, that's impossible, he has integrity, you have to die to be released from this. She didn't see that all of that would be given at the end, and who would, right? Good. And so it's just, that's something to consider. One other thing, Thomas, you asked earlier about Satan coming before God. Well, here you have an interesting one. Shall we not receive evil? It's talking about from God receiving evil. And again, this is where language and what the word is, and you have to be very careful with that. And I don't want to pretend like ESV got it wrong and Jay's got it right. Like, would never say any such thing. Yet that evil, that also is talking about disaster, which fits very well. And you got to be careful to not do what's that called? A what?
Word comparison. It meant that.
Yeah.
Hear what it means over there.
Yeah, that's right. And so that word for curse and even evil, as it's mentioned at a few different times, you got to be clear on what that is. And does evil come from God? I think disaster is a better word there. I think that fits better.
Yes, has adversity.
Adversity.
ESV.
Oh yeah, there's that version too. I forgot about that. yes, I know. I always say it's the not actual scripture Bible, but that's only in the battles we have. Yes, yes. No, it's actually, quite honestly, I use that in study. I personally like ESV. Obviously, it's a great translation, but I like reading from ESV better myself. So. Here's another quote as we finish up here, talking about suffering. Men seek explanation of suffering in cause and effect. They look backwards for a connection between prior sin and present suffering. The Bible looks forward in hope and seeks explanations, not so much in origins as in goals. The purpose of suffering is seen not as cause, but in its result. The man was born blind so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We don't have time to go in. In James 5, 7, 11, it does the same thing where it's speaking of Job. And then Hebrews 12, which was actually read this morning, 1 to 11, if you look there, what's being accomplished in the midst of that suffering. And then specifically Hebrews 5, really 7 to 9. But in verse 8, although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And it goes on to say, and was made perfect, right? So the Son of God was made perfect through suffering. And yet much of our lives and the world says the thing that we struggle with is, I don't deserve to suffer. Why me? Right? And yet our example in Christ is that he was perfected through suffering. So next week we'll be doing the end of chapter two and jumping into chapter three and looking at the three friends.